Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
It is no surprise that in today's day and age, data is ubiquitous. Every step we take is literally documented by multiple devices, from our smartphones and smartwatches to street cameras, allowing for massive data sets to be created. Hardly anyone understands all that is happening with these data, but we do know they are being used for marketing purposes. But what if the data would also be used for the greater good, like we are, for example, seeing in the current corona crisis? Would it not be possible to use data more for social justice in order to promote equality or to prevent crime? But then again, this could surely lead to some darker use patterns as well. Our guest today has been working on privacy compliance for multiple cloud companies, but also has a passion for ensuring that tech remains a force for good. I'm sure there will be lots to discuss on this week's episode of Serious Privacy. My name is Paul Breitbarth.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. I am absolutely thrilled today to bring you my friend Pedro. He is someone I've known in the privacy world for a few years now, and of course, we only ever see and talk to each other at privacy conferences. And there hasn't been privacy conferences to see and talk to each other this year, so I'm kind of in Pedro withdrawal here. So connected with him to see if he would join our podcast, and of course, he's delighted to do so. And we came up with some ideas that he wanted to touch on. But we all know the first thing we do is the unexpected question. And this isn't going to be as easy as the one we did for the Shrimps podcast. Let's see. Okay, Pedro, this is a great question. What new activity have you tried this year?
Wow. Well, obviously, first of all, let me say thanks for inviting me, Kay and Paul. I really appreciate being here and the energy you guys are bringing during times where none of us get to see each other. And thanks for the invite. Happy to be here. New things now. Okay, well, there's a couple. I live in a townhome. I have a balcony upstairs, and I installed like a fancy schmancy grill. And through trial and error, I'm trying to become like a real barbecue guru. I mean, I live in Atlanta. It's a barbecue town. I'm terrible. The 50% chance the food is good we're going to end up ordering out that night was an epic fail. I tried to like low and slow a pork shoulder and it was rubber.
Okay, pork shoulders are not for the newbies.
No, you know, and the thing is I'm Cuban, right? So I've been making pork shoulder in the oven for 1,000 years. I tried to do it outside and it was an epic fail. So that was no good. But the good news is I did some grilled chicken breasts and they were excellent. So anyway.
Have you tried shrimp yet?
I've tried shrimp and, you know, pretty good. I bought these fancy skewers and all this stuff. And so, yeah, I'm trying my heart out. My neighbor, he's got like a fancy egg. And so he shows off every day. I'm actually looking at his house right now. And he's always showing off with smells and things and briskets. And I'm like, all right, well, let me try to get hot dogs, then move to pork, then move to chicken, and then we'll see where it goes. But that's the new thing.
Very nice. What about you, Paul?
So the first new thing I started this year, or I tried this year, was snow scooter riding. While I was up in Lapland in February, when we recorded our very first episode, the day after I went snow scooter riding, which is a serious experience. It was a lot of fun to have this big machine under you and just go up a hill through the snow in the cold and with hardly any light because it's still dark in January almost all day round in Lapland. So that was pretty much fun. More during the corona times, the new thing I've tried is making ice cream.
Nice.
So if you do dinner, then I'll do dessert.
Nice.
I'll show Kate up and bring the wine. Taste tester.
You bring the alcohol.
Yes.
That's true. That's the famous question. What kind of wine do you like? Whiskey.
Yes.
Okay. What have I done new? Basically nothing. I have to say, I'm the same old boring person I've been doing, although I do have to say that doing this podcast has inspired me to try to go ahead and launch my own personal, well, with my husband, our own personal YouTube channel.
Nice.
And podcast. And so we've got the setup and everything now, so we'll see. I thought about using a fake name, and then I'm like, everyone's going to know who I am anyway, so why does it really matter? I even bought a wig. I was going to do a whole persona. No, people are going to know who I am, so there's no sense hiding it. All right, let's get on to the substantive matter of the podcast. This part might actually be more fun. But okay, Paul, what do we got? What are we starting with?
Well, I know it's by now 2 weeks since the Schrems decision, at least by the time the episode comes out, but it's still very much top of mind. So yeah, let's just still talk about Schrems 2. We promised our listeners we would keep them up to date on any changes that might happen. Of course, we record a bit in advance, so we don't know all the latest guidance, but Pedro, Salesforce obviously was a Privacy Shield user. What are you looking at the moment? What kind of challenges and solutions do you see?
Well, you know, Schrems 2, I've tweeted about this and posted on LinkedIn. So first I'll talk about my personal view and then maybe a little bit about what Salesforce is up to. But, you know, the question I always ask myself when a new privacy law comes out or a judicial decision related to privacy comes out is, are people's privacy rights more preserved today than they were yesterday before this decision or this law went into effect, right? And, you know, I don't know what the impact of Schrems 2 and the invalidation of Privacy Shield will be insofar as, you know, improving EU citizens' privacy. So, I don't think it does a lot in that regard. What it definitely does do is, you know, eliminate one mechanism that lots of companies, I think 5,000 or so, use to export data out of the EU to the United States. And so, luckily, the decision didn't go in so far as to invalidate the other existing mechanisms, right? And you know, we'll have to see when similar rationale for invalidating Privacy Shield is applied to the model clauses in depth. I think this court kind of danced around the model clauses a little bit and the VCRs and see how that plays out, if it plays out, and hopefully it doesn't anytime soon. But, you know, my reaction to it is kind of mixed. I don't think anyone's privacy rights are expanded or better preserved today than they were yesterday because the day after the decision than they were the day before the decision because there are other mechanisms for which to move information across the Atlantic. And then two, I think it just makes it harder to have conversations with customers and partners and vendors and the public about, you know, what it means to transfer data from Europe to the United States and what the implications are for people's privacy in the EU when that does happen. You know, Salesforce, this is all public information, so anybody can go on our website and see it, you know, has had VCRs for some time. And so, you know, our reaction has been very much to make everyone aware that that mechanism is available with respect to most of our services, as well as the model clauses. So I think our position has been very much, what does this mean for us and our customers, and what can we do to make sure that, you know, our services continue to operate effectively in light of the decision? You know, we've been preparing for it for a long time, and, you know, I think at least for now we're in pretty good shape to continue our operations. But we'll have to see what Mr. Schrems does or anybody else with respect to the, you know, model clauses and BCRs and determine, you know, what their longevity is going forward. It's just, to me, it's an annoying time, because we know what doesn't work, but we still don't have any idea what the long-term viability of the other mechanisms are. So it's a little scary.
Right.
That's the hard thing with the courts. They always tell you what not to do, but they never provide the real solution. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And I remember when Safe Harbor was invalidated, that Salesforce.com immediately sent out standard contractual clauses to everyone. So that, I mean, literally like within 2 weeks of it. So y'all have always been pretty much on top of responding to the actions and trying to do or figure out what you think the right thing to do next is, and then be on top of that. And I know I, for one, have always appreciated that.
Okay, setting aside the Schrems decision, because that's not the main reason why we invited you. I already referred to it during the introduction of the episode. You are very passionate, from what I've read and heard, also about using technology as a force for good. Can you tell us a bit more about why that is?
Well, it's a couple of things, and that's a great question. You know, the why is a question I don't get very often. I think for me, you know, my personal history and background very much affects how I practice law and how I think about technology and its implications, whether good or bad. And one of the things that I see, one of the worldviews that I take into account when I see how technology impacts people is my parents. You know, I'm an immigrant. My parents are immigrants. You know, we grew up very humbly. We had a language barrier. I didn't learn to speak English till I was in school. And my parents, you know, English was their second language, and they had to fight really hard to speak it and learn it. And so while I think generally innovation almost always has, you know, kind of positive effects on most people, there can be scenarios in which groups are excluded or groups are impacted negatively by innovation. And I think particularly when it's related to how we process people's information, especially their private and personal and sensitive information, being vigilant to ensure that the outcomes that arise from use cases that involve people's most delicate records and delicate bits of information about themselves, that those outcomes are positive and overwhelmingly beneficial to all groups within society, not just kind of traditional groups that tend to benefit from, you know, industrial expansion and improvement. I think my passion comes a lot from my family and my background and understanding, you know, discrimination and disparate impact, not just intellectually, but from life experience.
You know, I agree with that. And I resonate with what you say. It goes back to your parents and your background, because when you mentioned you wanted to talk about social justice, I did a little bit of research into it. And there's this one that I found. It's a cartoon, but it puts some very, very important points up front. One of it says, you know, why is privacy a social justice issue? And it says people from oppressed populations often have less privacy. People, communities, and governments are more intrusive into the details of the lives of marginalized populations. And it gives the example of the genitals of trans people are often considered public knowledge. Have you had surgery yet? What bathroom can you use? Something as simple as that. So that really resonated to me. And then, of course, the next one is racist policing places increase state scrutiny on the bodies and lives of people of color. And also a privacy issue and an intrusiveness issue. This brings back to mind something we were just talking on an episode with Professor Dan Solov on how the ACLU in California is opposing the California Privacy Rights Act. And they're saying that it takes away the privacy rights of people. It's really only protecting the privacy rights of those who are well off or rich. And it's putting people in underrepresented populations in the position of not having privacy because they can't afford to pay for it. All of this really just resonates as to how do we fix it?
Yeah. No, I could.
Is it true?
It's definitely true that the privacy of traditionally marginalized people or discriminated against people, which by the way includes women in general.
Yes.
Women's sexuality and personal choices are a matter of public debate all the time. You know, on Capitol Hill, at the state capitol, and everywhere in between. And so, yes, I think it's definitely true that without vigilance and deliberate focus on ensuring that innovation and technology don't negatively or disparately impact groups that are underrepresented typically in the debate and are talked about but are not talked to very often, you end up with results that aren't great. One of the things you talked about, this like ability, privacy, one of the things I worry about is the you know, freemium is turning into an option where it's like, okay, freemium means, you know, we can monetize your data, but if you're willing to pay $100 a year, we won't. Right. And that is you know, it's selling privacy as a luxury item. You know, and like, for example,
rather than a fundamental right,
like in Europe, where it's an actual fundamental right. And in the United States, you know, construed, interpreted right. that we have based on other kind of, you know, on the Bill of Rights. And so, you know, I worry about this idea of pay for privacy because it excludes lots of people. And it's not just poor, right, which it definitely excludes, but it excludes, you know, people who might not understand the impact of the, you know, monetization of their identity and their private information and would make choices differently if they really did. So I think there's the issue of, you know, availability of information and actionable intelligence about how companies and governments use your information. And then the other one is not creating paywalls and turning privacy into a luxury.
Right. Because I think about it, it's not only that, it's the fact that particularly for underrepresented populations, understanding is one thing, but it also goes back to a history. I mean, I don't want to make this a podcast about discrimination. We all accept that that's there. But because of the discrimination, there is more information publicly available about a lot of populations.
Correct.
Because there's more surveillance. There's more government activity. There's more whatever you want to call it.
No doubt about it. Like, you know, one of the use cases I focus on the most is this idea of, you know, predictive policing and how the leveraging of surveillance information, but also information purchased by law enforcement about people,
right,
is used to make decisions about people's freedom, okay, and people's, right, you know, police interactions, right? And so this idea that certain groups have higher propensities to commit crimes than others, based on data that is skewed for the reasons you just explained.
Inherently biased
and disproportionate is not something that we should take lightly or allow. And so, you know, we call that tech washing, right? Like, well, no, the cops might be biased, but the technology is. Well, the information that the technology is using is extremely, right, biased because it's based on the information of the cops that we're saying are biased in the first place.
Right.
Right. And so,
yeah, we completely
and it is reinforcing itself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's not to pick on police officers, but it is to pick on law right, enforcement policy. Right. Which,
yeah,
you know, historically hasn't really taken into account how decisions made about how to police and where to police and when to arrest and whom to arrest, you know, lead to data being skewed in directions that maybe aren't obvious when you're collecting the information and putting it together. But then when you go and take a look and you juxtapose the data you have about arrest versus the realities in the population about crime and propensity to do things, you realize that there's a big gap. And that's troublesome.
Right.
Yeah, troublesome.
And for people that don't really understand how the bias gets into technology, it can be something as simple as historical data will show that 90% of police stops on the road are Americans.
Yeah.
Well, that objective data feeds into the bias because really the people that were stopped have no better reason for being stopped than the people who were not stopped. But however, the objective data shows that 90% of people who are stopped are African American. Therefore, 90% of your efforts should go towards stopping more African Americans. That's inherently biased.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you mm-hmm. know, I'll give you an example of how this plays out in the real world, right? And the numbers aren't, they're approximate here because I don't have the data in front of me, but.
My 90% is just a number pulled out of the ether.
I don't want somebody to come back to the podcast and be like, hey, it was 91%, not 92%, you know, this kind of thing. So, so I'm approximating here, but you know, we did a study, well, I didn't do this, but I saw a study about hate crime complaints, right? And hate crime investigations in the United States. And it was in the context of a discussion about the effectiveness of hate crime laws and whether they're needed. Georgia just passed one a few weeks ago. We're very proud of that here. And it was bipartisan. The governor signed it into law. And Georgia was one of the few states that did not have a hate crime law. And now we do. So I'm very proud of.
Whereas my home state just voted to get rid of the Confederate flag symbol out of the state flag. So, hey, woohoo for the southern states.
Yeah, which this is advanced progress. I lived in Mississippi a long time and I love Mississippi very much. But, you know, I was also proud of that change because it took guts and it's overdue, but, it, you know, it's still progress. So with all of this being said, the example went something like this. You know, in California, there'd been in a certain year, I don't remember the specific year, you know, just over 1,000 hate crime investigations that the police had actioned on, right? And in the state of Mississippi, which we just talked about, you know, there'd been, I think it was two or three, And so if you look at that data from 1,000 feet, you go, wow, Mississippi doesn't have a hate crime problem. California is where all the problems are. But the reality of that situation is much more complicated, right? Which is which is very likely the fact that in California, people are much more conscious about what a hate crime is and how that works. And you know, in Mississippi, maybe some things go unreported, go uninvestigated. There's less police, you know, there's less police involvement, meaning there's just less police officers, period, in the state. There are less resources.
Who knows? That objective data of only two investigations is not reflective of reality.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you just use the data to make decisions about, you know, social justice and social equality and racial equality, you know, you're using data that essentially is flawed, because we know without any kind of statistical analysis that that is probably very unlikely that there were really only two. And it might have been Alabama, to be honest with you, but it doesn't matter. It makes the point. It was a southern state where this happened. And, you know, that was eye-opening for me, because, you know, with respect to the leveraging of data for social justice causes, you can run into these types of issues.
Yeah.
So let's not beat a court here. Let's not just conclude what's wrong, but see if we can also answer what needs to be done. And this might be too big a question, but how do we solve bias in AI?
Yeah, okay.
Ooh.
So let me grab this magic wand here. You know, I don't know. I mean, that is a gigantic question. And it's honestly somewhat philosophical, because I don't know if that's possible, right? I don't know if all bias can be removed from anything that involves human input or the analysis of human activity, right? Because that takes a human or a machine to do it. And both are going to be guided by the experience they're fed, whether that's data to a machine or whether it's someone's life experience who's making the analysis. So I don't know that we can solve the bias problem completely, but there are certainly ways to reduce it, right? And I think, to me, one of the most effective ways is on the engineering end of things. And sounds weird. So when you're designing products that probe people's privacy or use people's personal information to make predictive decisions or to make estimations or for whatever purpose, ensuring that at the engineering phase, you've included a diverse group of people in the creation of the technology helps tremendously. This is something I used to talk about at Oracle all the time, and I talk about here at Salesforce, and I talk up to anybody who's willing to listen. You know, if you have a bunch of, you know, millennial or Generation Z white guys from Berkeley designing an AI algorithm that's going to make decisions about identity based on facial recognition, and you only feed it information about that homogenous group to learn how to operate, it's going to make mistakes when it's analyzing people from other groups. And having a diverse design process, to me, makes it much more likely that that'll get flagged at the engineering phase, right? Which is, hey,
well, but it's not just having the diverse population in the engineering process, Pedro. Let's be honest. It's making sure that they know to be actively aware that we expect their contribution in the engineering process to make things more socially justice.
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, you don't want to put the burden on the people that are being marginalized to solve the problem. But their presence in and of itself is an improvement on the status quo, right? So Silicon Valley has a long way to go on the diversity front, especially in the engineering and business side of things, not to mention on the legal side. There are not a lot of privacy Pedros walking around, and that's a problem.
There's really not. We need more privacy Pedros.
Well, and privacy Marias and all kinds of things. And so, you know, we need to do better in how we represent and create teams that develop these technologies, because I think the likelihood of flags being raised early, not on the back end when you see the problematic outcome, but on the front end, will help quite a bit. So that's one thing that I think really helps. And I think the other piece is to reduce barriers to less biased data sets, right? And right now we've got a bunch of barriers. One is intellectual property. Another one is copyright, intellectual property, paywalls, trade secret, all these reasons why, you know, we can't get at the best data to do the best model training. And so what happens?
You need more data to have more privacy.
You need better data to have more privacy, right?
There we go.
You need better data, and that usually includes having more of it. But yeah, you need better data. So, you know, using Wikipedia as your general knowledge source has some benefits. There's a lot, and it's a big, wide scope of information. But if you go look and see who generally is updating Wikipedia and who's creating the content on that site, it's like 20-something white guys from North America. So that's going to mean that everything in that, you know, well, not everything, but a lot of the content that's being used for general knowledge information might have a skew based on who the demographic is that's creating the content. And so that's something we need to be very aware of. And then the point you made earlier, Kay, is right on, which is, you know, over-reliance on, you know, historical data sets, like, you know, police arrests in Michigan in the 60s. I mean, look, I already know. I don't have to go look at the data, right?
Right.
You know, or whatever, and whatever it is. And so over-reliance on, you know, old literature to determine translation and speaking algorithms, right, that are interactive. You know, I get really frustrated with Alexa and Siri, and they both just lit up as I said that, which is really strange. But they literally both are here and just lit up. So, but I get frustrated with them because I don't have a heavy accent, but I have one. And I speak with a certain whatever it is that I have that isn't maybe necessary.
Yeah, they don't like me.
They definitely don't like you. So it's not even about just like, you know, racial equality, but it's like, hey, like, how do people speak today? Don't feed, you know, books from the 1800s into these algorithms and teach them how to understand English. You got to teach them real English or real Spanish or whatever it is. The way
I was going to say, but not English English. It needs to be American English
whatever
or South American English.
Exactly.
You know, Dutch English,
you know, take into account dialect and intonation and regional variants when you create these things, because, you know, if not, then someone speaking to one of these tools in Louisiana might have a very different experience than someone speaking to the tool in San Francisco. And that's not a good outcome, right? Like, it might not be a social justice issue, but it definitely is a goofy outcome that we don't want.
I'm actually surprised it does a pretty good job, all things regarding, but
compared to other technology, yes.
Yeah.
I have to laugh.
We're certainly not perfect.
My husband's a tech guy, and he brings all the wonderful technology home, the Google Homes, the Nest things, the doorbells, the everything. And I have to constantly remind him, do you even know what I do for a living? And I've got a Google Home sitting in my house. But on the other hand, I know what the history is with some of these smart home accessories. So at random times, I'll walk through the kitchen and be like, stop hitting me. No, you can't cut my leg off. No, just random things.
Just confusing.
Yeah. Yep. Well, you know, they use it as transcriptions and evidence if a crime occurs. Mm-hmm. So I just randomly walk through and accuse him of crimes. And
Yes. At
one point, he made the statement of, shouldn't you have more passion in your voice? I'm like, oh, no, they're just looking at the written transcription,
right.
Not
That's
the
right.
verbal.
That's right. That's right. That's absolutely right. So we'll see. And, you know, I know this is a privacy podcast. You know, one of the things that I think about all the time is, you know, I think screens are getting smaller, not bigger.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to lose a lot of screens in the next 10 or 15 years. And so and interact with the internet in a different way, much more voice and than whatever. Tactile or whatever it is we do with our hands. And you know, the implications of that are great in some ways. I mean, just think about folks with certain physical disabilities and you know, and the ability to do all sorts of interesting things. But the challenges are big. The privacy challenges are gigantic. You know, from a social justice perspective, very much matters. I mean, we can get into that if you want, but just from a general privacy perspective, one of the interesting things is what is incidental listening mean, right? Like if you're talking to a
always on,
if you're talking to the device and your children are in the background, like does COPPA apply? Like what does it all mean, right? Like, you know, how the rules will be applied to the listening internet, to me, it's a fascinating subject. So
it really is, because I believe there was a story about a smart device that picked up an emergency situation and alerted someone, which sounds like a wonderful use of technology. But how do you differentiate an emergency situation from something like what I said,
Someone
just randomly saying something, relating an article they talked about. So these devices that are always on and always listening are collecting a lot of data.
Yep.
And so this came up in another podcast as well, Paul, talking about the difference between privacy and data protection. Privacy is a right. Data protection is a set of rules.
Yeah.
No, it's also right here in Europe.
Right. Well, it's rights. But what I mean is privacy doesn't give companies a set of rules to go by. data protection laws and things give companies a set of rules to go by. And the CCPA has been criticized for all it's doing is giving a right of privacy or giving individual rights to their data. It's not giving companies rules to go by other than the transparency and the notice and some enforcement, which is interesting.
It is not a full playbook, whereas GDPR is a full playbook, step by step. What can you do with data from the moment you get it until the moment you get rid of it?
I mean, look, there are advantages and disadvantages of approaching privacy prescriptively or data protection prescriptively. Look, the Constitution is not that prescriptive. I mean, it has some things that it says.
And it's interpreted in tons of ways.
Yeah, for the last 200 years, right? And look, I mean, it's got some things.
Even by the Supreme Court.
Right, yeah, that's their job, right? And so, you know, it's got some things that are obviously prescriptive, you know, three branches of government, whatever, you know, but, you know, freedom.
That's a question, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, you know, I mean, just think about the amount of jurisprudence around like freedom of speech, right? And think about how it's actually written in the Constitution about it. It's, you know, a couple of lines. Right. And then we spent the last 200 years figuring it out. That is, you know, there are pros and cons to either approach, but I totally agree with you. Like, we need to think of privacy less about creating guidelines for companies and more about establishing rights and protections for people. And then data protection being the framework in which companies can operate, thinking about privacy as a rights framework for people, right? Meaning it's not things companies can do prescriptively, but it's inherent rights that people have that are being recognized in law. And then creating a data protection scheme that is more prescriptive to observe those rights and respect those rights.
Right.
Is probably the right formula. You know, this isn't a critique of GDPR, but, you know, I think we need to be less lazy as lawyers and want everything spelled out for us and like do our jobs, you know, anyway.
Right. Giving people rights does not mean you need to put the burden on the people to enforce and protect and make sure the rights. It means giving people rights and expecting company to do the right socially responsible thing. And having the power to leverage the data in responsible ways.
Exactly. Same page.
I mean, you can still get very innovative with data and still do it while respecting people's privacy.
Yeah. Look, there's lots of interesting use cases and things that we can do because of the advancements in technology, particularly AI, machine learning, deep learning, all of these things. Just because you can do things doesn't mean you should. And that's a lesson Silicon Valley has to learn. Okay. Like, you know, there's lots of things we've been able to do for a long time that we don't do because they're dangerous or harmful or you know, would create chaos. And so the same applies to Silicon Valley and technology. You know, you might come up with a really cool idea and a really cool use case for personal information that maybe solves one problem, but it is too intrusive or it leverages data that is too sensitive and it shouldn't be allowed. You know, every society and every country has to decide what those parameters are for themselves. You know, this idea that there's going to be a global standard. No, there isn't for anything. I mean, like, you know, the drinking age is not universal. People drink at different ages. They vote at different ages. You know, you get your driver's license at different stages in life. You get it taken away in some places. You pay taxes differently depending on where you live. And so, you know, we're going to have to decide for ourselves what privacy means. And that's not going to be one clean, finite, easy to understand global standard. So I think we just have to get used to the mishmash because that's how it's going to be. The way they think about privacy in India is different than in Europe and different in the United States. And within the United States, it's different in California than it is in Missouri. That's just the reality.
I find that interesting because having a global standard seems to be a very popular concept among people. And I get it. Countries do lots of different things at different ages, and there's lots of different rules, but there are some things that are universal. So I'm going to be a little bit of a devil's advocate here and say, yeah, but baseball is played the same everywhere.
Not so really.
There is the possibility. I mean, isn't it three strikes, you're out, and you have to hit the ball? And
so there are some universal principles for something to be baseball, right? But baseball isn't even played the same in the United States. Like, so if you play as a child, you hit a tee. If you play in college, you use an aluminum bat. If you play in the major leagues, you use a wooden bat. The equipment you wear is different. The umpire rules are different. The strike zones are different. So while baseball has to have certain themes to be baseball, otherwise it's something different, They don't play baseball exactly the same as we do in Japan.
I kind of like this idea.
So what about technology standards? We have technology standards. A USB key or USB plug is the same wherever you are in the world, which wherever you buy your computer, it's the same USB port that you have on your computer where the same cable fits wherever I buy it.
Yeah, that's a great thing and it's an advantage, but that same USB cable plugs into a laptop that the charger I have here in the States won't work in France. So like, you know, these issues are there, right? And, you know, this idea that universality is the solution to privacy is not true.
Universality, I like it.
I think I might've made that up, but you know.
I like the word though, it makes sense.
Yeah, we just need a global government that can deal with all of this. Yeah. One global government.
Let's have a privacy.
World domination.
A privacy king that or queen. Well, no, let's be real. Yeah, no, let's make it real patriarchal too, right? That just tells us all how to do things. No, like, just think about China, okay? And I'm not an expert on Chinese culture, so I, you know, whatever. But their worldview as a society is different than the United States, right?
And right.
So, you know, expecting them to follow the same privacy framework and model doesn't make sense. They don't follow the same anything model. And they say the same thing about us. That's the key. Like,
right.
they look at the United States and go, half the stuff that they do over there is bananas. It doesn't make sense, you know? Like, and so I think it's a little bit like, you know, it's one of these kind of Western concepts that, you know, we're going to tell everyone what's best. No, people have to decide for themselves what's best for them. And then we all have to figure out how to make it all work amongst ourselves. That's the only way people can be truly free. Otherwise, you're chilling people in ways that gets back to the premise of this whole conversation, which is social justice. If I go to your society and I tell you, you've been doing this a certain way for 3,000 years, now you got to do it differently because we've advanced, you know, you're being a little bit of a jerk. And so I just don't think that's the way we're going to get to any kind of global interoperability. That's what the goal should be, is that our frameworks, however diverse they are, work together. That's got to be the goal. We do that for taxes and tax law, right? Like tax regimes aren't the same in every jurisdiction. They're not the same in every county in the state of Georgia, right? And somehow we make it work. I think privacy is the same way. And that's how you preserve people's rights to be themselves, especially historically marginalized groups and countries that might have norms that are different. But I'm not making a better or worse judgment call, just different.
I don't hear a lot of support for the Dallas Agreement that was floated in this podcast 2 weeks ago as some sort of Paris Climate Agreement, but then for privacy.
Yeah, I mean, look at the Paris Climate Agreement itself. Not every country's a member. I know of a really fancy one that walked away from it, right? And so I don't agree, but it happened. And so, like, not everybody participates. And not only that, I think most reasonable people agree that protecting the planet is important. I think most reasonable people agree that protecting people's private space and ability to exclude others from their affairs is important. Not all people agree, but most reasonable people do. It's the how to make that work that's going to change and going to vary. And we have to allow for that variance so people can be free. You're not free if you're being told what to do and you don't agree. That's not free. That's not liberty. That's not a justiciable or an outcome that is the highest form of justice or equality. I just don't think so.
I love it. Establish a few fundamental truths and then find a way for the truths among countries to interoperate with each other.
Yeah, I think interoperability, in my opinion, is the higher, more evolved goal of privacy frameworks working globally than imposing your will on everyone and saying, this is the way we are, and therefore you can't have access to our stuff and we don't want to do business with you. That doesn't happen in any other context, with some exceptions. Does it need to be that way here? I don't see why.
Well,
I love it. And I love ending on this note. So
absolutely.
I'm going to throw it to Paul and say, Paul, bring us to a close.
I agree. This is a great note to end. And to all our listeners, if you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so new episodes will flow automatically in your list. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter at podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Thank you again for listening to Serious Privacy. Until our next episode, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, everybody.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.